Okay, we're on page 138, and Elder Simeon is going to talk about the fact that the idealized image, in addition to replacing and substituting for self-confidence, it also substitutes for and replaces ideals. The idealized image substitutes for self-confidence and also substitutes for the person's ideals. Because man doesn't come from himself, our existence doesn't come from ourselves, we try to create ourselves so that we don't have to depend on God. And the way we do that is by creating an idealized image of ourselves. So we idealize the way we are as the result of the things that have worked for us. We want to have a whole sense of ourselves as a whole person. We're compelled to have some sense of ourselves as a whole person. And so we take the things that work for us and we put them together, and they become an idealized self-image. For some people, this idealized self-image is exactly what we would expect. That is, some people identify with it and they think that they are already their idealized self-image, and they use it to judge other people and they feel superior. But Elder Simeon has also pointed out to us back on page 127 that it doesn't work that way for all people. Some people have an idealized self-image, an image of themselves as they would be if they would be perfect according to this idealized self-image, what they think is the way they really ought to be. But it isn't necessarily, as it is with some other people, that they think that they really are already this ideal. Some people look at their situation, see how they are in the world and with other people, and they compare it with this idealized self-image, and they think in their minds, I am a low, low person compared to the way I ought to be. And so they have what Elder Simeon has called a negative self-criticism. They don't even give themselves credit for being the way they actually are, he says. They think they're lower than they are in reality. So the idealized self-image, it's placed above them. It's unrealistic, it's made up, they made it up themselves, but it's the way they think they ought to be, and they judge themselves in terms of that idealized self-image. Sometimes big chunks of that idealized self-image comes from the ideals of the world around us. We compare ourselves with that, and it becomes part of our idealized self-image. For some people, it results in a negative self-criticism, and they have an unrealistic, negative, critical attitude toward themselves. So whichever way it is, and he gives one other example, but we won't go through all of them. It's all a matter of the fact that since we don't come from ourselves and we're not this created self-image, this self-created self-image, God has created us already, you know. But if we're distant from God and we don't have access to Him, we don't have communion with Him, and we want to have some sense of ourselves, we come up with this self-image. So since we don't come from ourselves, but we come from somewhere else, and we depend on something else, we all seek something outside of ourselves that will support us. Man can't be supported only on himself. We could say, then, that ideals play such a role. Now, Elder Simeon's approach here in this book is that ideals, for people who don't have communion with God, and their ideal isn't Christ, but they do have a set of ideals. Some people have a set of ideals, and they try to live up to that set of ideals. It's not an idealized self-image, but it's a set of ideals that they understand applies to everybody. And so Elder Simeon is talking about the fact that ideals can play a role of being something that is outside of us, that doesn't come from us. It might be social ideals, they might be ideals of the church. You know, people are at different levels spiritually. We can understand Christianity as a set of ideals, And we don't know God yet, but at least we have those Christian ideals. But what he's saying is that an idealized image of ourselves even substitutes for ideals. And he says, you must have heard people say, my life doesn't have any meaning. The person who says that his life doesn't have any meaning has no ideals. Beyond the fact that someone who says such a thing can't be a person of faith, and it's impossible to say that he believes in God, he also doesn't have any ideals. Ideals sustain people. They give us a sense that life is worth living because they're objective values that we understand as applying to everyone. But if we're depending on an idealized self-image, that puts itself in the place of ideals. Just like he said earlier, that it puts itself in the place of self-confidence. We don't have any real self-confidence because we don't have a realistic understanding of the way we actually are. We don't have any way of realistically criticizing ourselves in comparison to what? If a person has a set of high ideals, we can compare ourselves to those high ideals and we see that we fall short, but our life has meaning because we are straining to move toward those ideals. That's a kind of a secular parallel to Christian life, where what a Christian has, a true Christian has, is a recognition of Christ, who is not a set of ideas, but he is an ideal because he's the ultimate and ideal way of being a human being in communion with God. And so he's an ideal that is real, the incarnate Son of God. The Christian ideal is an incarnate ideal, not a set of ideas or values, but you want to see how it is that we are supposed to be, you look at Christ, because he is perfect God and perfect man. Move toward him. So on the one hand, you could be somebody who struggles to move toward a set of ideals, or you could be a Christian who struggles to move toward Christ, and you evaluate yourself in terms of Christ. The person who is spiritually ill evaluates himself or herself in terms of an ideal self-image. It may be a person who believes they fulfill that ideal self-image, or it may be a person who believes they fall way short, and so they think very, very little of themselves. But either way, they are judging themselves in terms of something that they've created, something that isn't real. There is a kind of objective reality to ideals that aren't created by ourselves, but are shared by all human beings as human beings. There really are ultimate human values that are ideals. Those things have a reality. It's not the same kind of incarnate reality that the Son of God has, but at least we're moving towards something that isn't self-created. We're moving towards something that is beyond ourselves. We're going above and beyond ourselves. So that's what he's talking about here, that if you have an idealized self-image, it keeps you from being able to have ideals, and it also keeps you from being able to believe in the Son of God. Incarnate reality. I do think that is exactly what he's saying. And the person who's going to create an idealized image, the idealized image comes into his existence precisely in that place where his ideals should be. If you like, let's say more concretely, if I'm ruled by an idealized image I've created, it isn't possible for me truly to believe in Christ, to turn toward Christ, to depend on Christ. It's impossible because what would cause me to be brought to Christ is already engaged and it's already ruled by the idealized image. And so there is no room for Christ. I think that's one of the more difficult sections in this part of the chapter. Is it clear to people? Does it make any sense to people?
Yeah, I can see it's hard.
Does it?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The tricky thing for me when I first read it was that I wasn't sure, what does he mean by ideals? It's possible for me. Now me, with my background, my tendency would be as an Orthodox Christian priest to be suspicious of set of ideals, because it's a set of ideas, a set of values that isn't Christ. It's not created by the individual, but could we say it's created by human beings? I think that place is reserved in Elder Simeon's way of thinking for what he calls the collectivized, idealized image. So when I took this business as a whole, then it started to make sense for me. So I tried to put it the way I did. I'm going to ask you, as my good and honest and ultimate critic, if what I said makes sense to you.
Well, like our society would have a set of ideals, well, or we might have a set of ideals of saying that we're going to be a, we're going to have a profession. I can see some
professional ideals.
Yeah,
they can make life worth living. Absolutely.
You know, like for myself, like being a nurse, so I have professional ideals where I'm going to treat, you know, people in a certain way, and
right,
and do certain things, and be organized in a certain way, and have a whole set of beliefs about how things are in the world, just that go along with my professional ideals.
And those professional ideals are shared by other nurses.
Right, right. And so I judge myself lots of times by those professional ideals. And
makes your work worthwhile.
Yeah, right. Right. And so I could be pretty unhappy if I don't live up to those ideals at a certain time.
And I think you can run into, are you finished?
Yeah.
You can run into people who are not able to work like that because, in Elder Simeon's terms, instead of that commitment to those professional values and ideals, they have an idealized image of themselves that is in the way. They're not able to function as good nurses because they think they're it. Their values have to do with this self-created image of themselves. I think that's the kind of conflict he's talking about. That if you have an idealized self-image, you're not able to function according to a set of ideals. That's, I think, essentially what he's saying. So it will keep you from doing that, as well as keeping you from being able to believe in God. Can't believe in God, doesn't have any ideals, can't have any ideals. Because for him, he or she judges himself or herself in terms of this idealized image of themselves. That, I think, is what he's saying there. Anybody else? Okay. Over on page 139, beginning of the second paragraph, three lines down. If we create an idealized image and we're in the grip of it and we fill our soul with it, our soul can't turn in any other direction. So it keeps us from functioning in terms of professional ideals. It also keeps us from functioning in terms of a spiritual life that goes beyond ourselves. And we defend this, as he said in the past, we defend that we fill our soul with this idealized self-image. We don't want to see it break down because we feel that we're destroyed if we lose this idealized image. So if we're in this condition, we are reluctant to change in any way. We won't allow it in any way to escape from us, nor do we dare to admit that it's mistaken, a lie, a mirage. Because as soon as we believe that it's a lie, a mirage, something non-existent, we feel that we are destroyed. I'm going to jump down to the next paragraph and put things together in this way. It's extremely difficult to get such a person to understand that he should detach himself from this idealized image and pursue something else. Because the person's whole sense of who they are and the meaning of life is tied up with this idealized self-image that is self-created. Such a person is not able to understand anything else. Because remember, elsewhere he says, if this is our condition, we understand everything in terms of our idealized self-image. It filters out as not good anything that doesn't fit with the idealized self-image. it's positive toward anything that does fit. And so it works as a filter. And it keeps us from being able to understand anything that doesn't fit into this idealized self-image, since his existence is supported on the idealized image. On the other hand, the idealized image is tearing apart his inner world. We're going to talk in the next page about how difficult it is for us to realize that there is an idealized self-image and that it's a problem. If we realize there's something wrong with it, even after we realize that, the idealized image will go away from within us very slowly. The person has to have a lot of faith, page 140, in order for this idealized image to go away quickly. He doesn't say it's impossible. It can happen. But you have to have a great deal of faith in God. Otherwise, we wouldn't have anything else to depend on. This should be taken into account by both the person who is trying to help such a person, but by also the one who is going to be helped. Because if we try to remove this idealized image immediately, we'll do harm instead of good. If someone were able to hold up a mirror to us and show us the idealized self-image, it will destroy us. We won't be able to deal with it. And so we have to be very careful. I'll mention an example from the Gerontocon. Now, I have a 4-volume set of the Gerontocon, but it doesn't have everything that is in the Gerontocon. It's a collection of stories, spiritual stories. And what Elder Simeon is going to do is he's going to quote from a more complete collection. At first, when I read this, I thought, oh, I'll look it up in my copy. But he says, this complete a copy is not available in English. One of these spiritual elders in the Gerontocon says, if you see someone doing some spiritual deed and you understand that he's doing it completely out of egoism, don't stop him. That's one point of view that one of the fathers says. Another Abba, however, says, if you see someone ascending to heaven by his own will, grab him by the foot and pull him down, for it will be for his own good. If in any case, in the saying we're quoting here, the Abba says, if you see someone doing some spiritual deed out of egoism, don't stop him, let him do it. Now, the full quotation is down here in the footnote on page 140. The Greek text of this exchange between the two fathers can be found in Domega Gerontocon, the whole, the full, the big Gerontocon. It has not been possible so far to locate this saying in an English language edition. Therefore, the passage is translated below. One of the fathers said, I hate to see young monks engage in vainglory, for they labor and gain no reward because they aim at the glory of men. Another elder, who had a better grasp of things, said to him, I accept them with great pleasure. It is better for a young man to be vainglorious than to be negligent, because when he aims at vainglory, he necessarily becomes self-controlled and keeps vigil and exposes himself to cold. He deprives himself, you see, and acquires love and undergoes difficulties to gain praise. After such a way of life, God's grace visits him and speaks to him as follows. Why are you working not for me, but for men? Then he is persuaded not to have his attention turned toward human glory, but toward the glory of God. Indeed, said the other elder when he heard this, that is the way things are. So that's interesting. That's interesting.
That reminded me of a time I was looking, got distracted at school and was looking at something other than my work. Then the professor came around, and then I told him, well, I got distracted here. And he looked at me and said, well, at least you're doing something.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it is, that does apply here because, and I think it's said more clearly somewhere else, that it's better for the person to be trying to do something that is, at least that they're doing something instead of being just completely unoccupied, you know, which is even worse. So, yeah, I do think that does apply. He's certainly doing this spiritual deed out of egoism, top of page 141, 4 lines down, and yet he's doing something and not remaining inactive. There you are. Well, one of these days he'll understand that his whole work is wasted since he does it out of egoism, and he may repent and start to do his work with humility. Whereas if he's doing nothing at all and he's just slothful, that's not even a possibility, you see. If you hinder him, you'll cause him to be completely deadened, overtaken by inaction, laziness, sloth, lack of interest in spiritual things. He will be overtaken by disappointment, by hopelessness, by a feeling that he doesn't have any purpose in life, that his life doesn't have any meaning, and he could go straight ahead and kill himself. So, better that he be deluded and occupied in something than you just pull him down by the foot, the way the other monk said. Then he just becomes inactive. This then is the meaning of the idealized image. It replaces a person's ideals. It replaces the person's genuine inclinations for this or that. And as it replaces those things, the person remains without ideals. He remains simply with the idealized image, which in the end leads him by the nose. I'm going to jump down about four lines. While you try to do something good, you're doing something else. Because your ideal, Christ, the church, holiness, no longer has any power to guide you, to govern your existence. You are dwelling somewhere else. You see the ideals, but they're outside of your existence. Inside you, in the place where ideals should be, is the idealized image, instead, ruling over you. Page 142. Make a little effort to see how inflexible this idealized image is. It isn't affected by words or anything else. We can't be talked out of it. We'll rebel against people who try to talk us out of it. It doesn't budge. It's established there. It holds on to us, but we hold on to it also. If we stop holding on to it, it will go away. So it has to be maintained. It needs fuel in order to keep going. The idealized image works from inside. We see everything by means of this image. This part we jumped to last week when Jimmy wanted to understand better how it is that we could see things as good that aren't good just because they fit with the image. We read this section then, putting that together last week. It causes us to see things as we see them. The person can be full of passions, weakness, he can have mistakes, errors, but he doesn't see them precisely because he puts this idealized image on top of them. In one person, who is a compliant type, who moves toward people, as we've said, in a person, that is, who needs others, depends on others, is attached to others, his idealized image is created in accord with his psychology, in accord with this psychological makeup of his. And so whatever serves this tendency he has is, for him, a virtue. And whatever doesn't fit is just not right. On the contrary, only what is contrary to this tendency does he see as a sin, as wickedness. The fear someone has inside him, the cowardice he has, a tendency he has to be attached, he doesn't by any means see these things as sins, as shortcomings, to strike down mercilessly. You know, and here's where the idea of tenderizing the octopus by smashing it on the rocks. And last week I accused Elder Simeon of treating us like an octopus. I mean, if we really get the force of what he's saying, he's very gentle. But if we really get it, if it really hits home, it's very painful. This can be a very painful book to read. So I said that it was an aggravating book. It's aggravating in a good way, though. He's tenderizing us. On the contrary, an aggressive type who moves against people sees things such as fear, cowardice, a disposition to show understanding toward others, a disposition for adjustment or compromise and so forth, as the greatest sins. So there's a different sense of what is virtuous that goes along with, that's compatible with aggression as a value. He sees as virtues attacking everyone continually, criticizing, knocking down continually, and examining others. This is how the idealized image, depending on its type, we'll see certain things as virtues that aren't virtues, and other things as vices that aren't vices, because this idealized image is there in place of a set of ideals. which would make it clear that a vice is a vice and a virtue is a virtue, even if we don't have the advantage of seeing Christ. We see Christ, then we know what's good and what isn't good. Here let me say that in the various organized religious groups, perhaps an idealized image is created without their realizing it, in keeping with the psychology each group has, with the psychological makeup its members have. And he makes a remark, that's why we don't communicate with one another. In other words, if you're part of a group that has one idealized image as a group, you are not going to understand, but you're going to condemn people of another, a different group that has a different, self-created, idealized image. This is where denominations come from. And
political
parties, but that's a sore spot. I avoid talking about those particular groups of collectivized, idealized images. But it's Orthodox, I was going to say, can also do this. It's one of the reasons that, especially here in the Diocese of the South, which we, as a small mission, we've always made an effort to try to reach out to other parishes nearby, to have people come and talk to us from outside, in order to avoid some kind of a congregationalized, idealized self-image that comes from us. We want to identify ourselves with the whole of Orthodoxy and break up, you know, this possibility that he's talking about here, because it can happen to Orthodox parishes, it can happen to groups of Orthodox parishes. We have to be on guard against it, you know, and we have the advantage we have, of course, is the presence of Christ in the church. Okay, each one in his group interprets the gospel in his own way and creates his own ethics. So something that is seen as a virtue in this group can be seen as a vice in the other group, and something that is seen as a virtue there can be seen as a vice. In our days, we Christians are victims of our egoism, of our arrogance, victims of our love, of ourselves, of our self-love. Page 142. This idealized image which plagues me can be an idealized image I created all by myself. But it can also be an idealized image that we've all created together. That is, since we agree, since we all have the same psychology, and it is this one thing, this fake thing, the devil has managed to create this idealized image. And that is what leads us hither and yon. I'll use this as an example. Say a group like Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State, they have a collective idealized image. They're not even good Muslims, but they have this collective idealized image. And it substitutes for ideals. And this can happen in lots of different groups. And then, of course, they condemn everyone. Christians, Americans, other Muslims in the governments that they want to overthrow, because they have this image of themselves, and that's what they have faith in. And remember, the possibility of seeing God is obscured by this. So they can't even be decent Muslims, let alone anything beyond that. Okay, the devil has managed to create this idealized image, and that is what leads us this way and that. And in this way, we don't see Christ, nor do we live Christ, nor do we get to know the true gospel, and as a consequence, we are not able to understand it and live it and apply it correctly. That's his explanation of how the idealized image replaces ideals and how it gets in the way of a journey toward Christ.
I remember, years ago, I remember when I was going to a Protestant church, I remember this leader from outside the church came and spoke to us, you know. Then he had some kind of personal word for me that, you know, he said, you've got a heart for God, like King David, you know.
Oh, yeah. They loved David. Pick on David. Poor David.
I said, he specifically told me that, you know. And it's just like, I swear, for like a couple of years, I really just felt like I really got it together. it's kind of how I felt, you know, for like a couple of years. I'd wrestled with this pride, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, because this guy came out, you know, And he was a big honcho according to everybody in our church. You know, this guy, if this guy says something to you, you know, it's solid gold. I mean, that's what he says right on the
mind. So you had an experience of moving toward this person.
Yeah, and just, you know, accepting what he said and just thinking.
Help you build an idealized self-image.
Just thinking that, yeah, that I really have it together because of what this guy just told me, you know.
Oh, David.
Yeah.
I've heard this from someone else.
Yeah, I guarantee you, you're not the only one that guy said that to.
And it's just like... And I just remember, you know, it's like it just took some time to say, okay, well, you know what? I really don't have it all together.
the only cure is recognizing reality.
Yeah.
That's where we start to see the holes in our idealized self-image.
And that kind of, you know, then that's led to struggles with just feeling like... maybe I really just don't love God at all. You know, you can go too far the other way too, you know,
right.
Which is, I have that tendency. If I'm too far one way, there's a good chance that I'll go too far the other way.
Right.
Before I'm going to get to where I'm supposed to be, you know, that, that middle path, you know. And,
well, you're not alone there, but, that's for sure. Okay, next section, the idealized image, our imaginary self. The fictitious image and the elements of reality that can be part of it. The idealized image can be characterized as our fictitious or imaginary self, something that doesn't exist in reality, but we've created it, fashioned it, we've imagined it ourselves. Most often there are elements of reality entangled with this imaginary and fictitious image, and that's the part that makes it difficult. To say, but we could always say to ourselves, but there's this part. I know that that part is real, that part may be real, but we put it together in a way to make an idealized image about ourselves. Let's explain. Someone truly believes in God, wants to believe in God, truly believes in the church, wants to believe in the church. He truly wants to live the Christian life. These are real elements. In other words, those are things that stand on their own. They're not things that we've made up. They are a necessity of, and I remember this very, very vividly in my own conversion experience, that once I'd lost confidence in everything that I could see that anyone had put together and lost confidence in my ability to put anything together myself that would hold up, as I used to say it then, under the weight of life. I went looking for things that had not been constructed or made up by anybody, and these are some of the things that I eventually discovered. They were not things that anybody had created, looking to make an idealized self-image all by themselves or with a group of people. None of those things would do it for me anymore. And I was good at seeing how things were put together because I had been trained to do that. These are real elements. These things are a necessity of his soul. They are operations of his soul. The soul is meant to be involved with God and the church and the Christian life. On the other hand, however, this person, either because he isn't very sincere before God and before himself, willing to lie to himself, you know, and others, or because he is psychologically an unhealthy type, creates an idealized image and binds himself to it. And so in the end, this idealized, imaginary, fictitious image is tangled up with real elements. Most of us are in this condition to one degree or another. Then a labyrinth is created in this way, and one can't make heads or tails of it. We get lost in the labyrinth. There are some real elements, but a lot of it is a fiction that we've made up. There are paths that lead in places where we think it's going to be good, and we end up at dead ends. That's what he's saying is the case for many of us.
What's a labyrinth?
A labyrinth, we talked about labyrinths before, is the original labyrinth was in the island of Crete underneath of the city. You would go underground and you'd go into a tunnel, and the tunnel would go this way and that, but like a maze. It's a maze. Go this way, that way, you try to get out, you get lost in the middle, and it's dark and you don't know which way to go. A labyrinth is a maze, and you get lost in the maze.
I see.
One dead end after another. Remember we talked about that.
I remember that. I forgot that word.
Labyrinth.
Thank you.
Sure. A fair number of you should have asked yourselves, he says, is it possible, now he encouraged us to do this earlier, is it possible that I too have an idealized image? Page 146. Sherry asked the other week, how do we know if we have an idealized image? The main thing, the big thing is when we finally get to the point that we question the possibility that we might, because chances are we do. There aren't going to be many exceptions. Reading this book has caused me to think about my past a lot, and I have a lot of past to think about. Mike and I have a similar situation that way. You have we don't think about the past, there's big gobs of it. And I can see one kind of idealized self-image early in my youth and adjustments to it and move into a slightly different kind of idealized self-image. That one crashes and you think it's gone forever, but people have to have, in order to continue, some sense of who they are. And so we start to build up a new one. And then we remember, but I used to have this idealized self-image. It fell apart for me, you know. So you start, during the course of your life, you can have, there's a kind of a history of idealized self-images. And all of them are nonsense. And you see through one, and then you see through another. You get lost in this labyrinth. You could write a history of that sort of thing in your life. Okay, where was I?
Chapter 146.
Okay, right. On the other hand, someone sees himself and questions himself, since I truly accept the gospel, I truly believe, I truly struggle, I truly want to be a Christian. Where, after all, is this idealized image? Here, the matter gets even more tangled up, since the imaginary and the fictitious elements are tangled with the real elements. The idealized image, this imaginary thing, this fictitious thing, which is our imaginary and fictitious self, always prevails over our real self and substitutes for it. And this is tricky too, I think, for us, because we tend to think, oh, I have a real self, maybe I'll discover that. But remember, all of the time Elder Simeon has spent trying to get us to recognize that our quote, real self, we can only discover by not moving toward others to try to get a sense of being held together because we're identified with others and or moving against them or hiding in ourselves. It's only in that place of silence where we don't depend on some made-up sense of who we are that we're not involved in this imaginary and fictitious idealized image. So the point that I'm making here is that our real self is not to have a devotion to any kind of self-image. It's to be self-image free. And that sounds almost like an impossibility. But the point that I'm making is, it's not like there is a kind of, let's say you made this, we could make this mistake converting to Orthodoxy or some denomination. We could think, okay, no more self-created idealized image. But here, this group has an understanding of things that I identify with. And we can make the mistake of identifying with a collective self-image of a group and think, that's who I really am. And that's wrong too. We don't need a self-image, because we are created by God to be free and not to move toward, against, or away from others, but to stand in a place of silence that is the appropriate stance before God. No idealized self-image is necessary. We don't have to substitute our freedom to stand in the presence of God. We don't have to substitute that freedom, that reality, for some idealized self-image, either one we made up or the one a group made up. That is our real self. Our real self is to stand in the appropriate place and way before God and not long for this false security of an idealized self-image. That, I think, can be tricky to keep in mind. The unhealthy type considers the imaginary, idealized image as real and identifies with it. And this fictitious, idealized image ends up overshadowing the real person. our real self, because we are somebody. And while a person struggles and tries to be a Christian, he ends up being neither a Christian nor faithful and has neither virtue nor spiritual life and wonders what's going on. He's continuing to describe our condition. The idealized image ensures an equilibrium, a balance in the person who has it. Many people would literally fall to pieces, completely lose themselves, if this idealized image were not there to save them. Up to a certain point, it does something good, keeps us from falling apart. Like the ego of the person who does good and maybe pious things, but for an egotistical reason. It's better than doing nothing at all. So the idealized image is better than completely falling apart, but we're depending on a fiction, a fictitious thing, something that's not real, and it can't last forever. Sooner or later, it will come apart. One of these days, the bomb is going to go off. Something else. Often, someone represses, holds down this idealized image that he identifies with, top of 147. This is even worse. In this case, one stops identifying with his idealized image, and since it's repressed, it's held down, he transfers it to another person. So there's an idealized image that we transfer to somebody else. That's the way I should be. And we idealize someone else, where actually it doesn't have anything to do with who that person happens to be, really. It's our image of ourselves transferred to another person. From that point on, he ceases to have a good opinion of himself, instead begins to admire someone else. Many times, one admires someone but doesn't admire the person himself, doesn't even see the person himself. He simply transfers to him the idealized image he has inside of him. There's a lot of that going on right now. He subjects himself to this person and does nothing but idealize and fawn upon his own idealized image, which he didn't have the courage to see in himself, and instead he's transferred it to another person. This is the reason that some souls are literally disappointed when the facts demonstrate that the person they had relied on so much, whom they had idealized so much, had admired so much, isn't at all like what they were thinking. I'm going to jump down four lines. So this soul literally collapses, disappointed, as if God, as if Christ did not exist, as if the church, the gospel did not exist. For this soul, the gospel, the church, Christ, were this person who was like a God, small g, inside of this soul. This soul is disappointed. It collapses unless it can be supported either with someone's help or by itself in order in the end to remain faithful to God, and is able to find God actually, and there to find its true and real ideal, and after it humbles itself before God, to be able to have a personal relation directly with God and not by means of other persons. Okay, that was really good. We will try to find almost any alternative to doing what we ought to do. I mean, after all, relationship to reality is going to be painful. It's going to be self-critical. It's going to involve repentance. It's going to involve change, which is terrifying to everybody. We've come up with ways of holding things together for ourselves, and the last thing we want to do is to let go of it. Sometimes a crisis can shake us up so much that we abandon it and we turn to recognizing the reality of things, the spiritual realities of life, and the necessity for God and the necessity for the one that Christ is. It's only who and what Christ is that resolves these dilemmas. Okay? What do people think about this? This topic has to do with the idealized image as our imaginary self. Can we see that we have an imaginary self?
Yeah, well, I guess Sherry asked, how can you tell if you've got an idealized image? And then you said the correct position is not to have an idealized image at all.
Which is a difficult
very
thing.
Difficult, which I guess kind of leads us to the realize that we probably have one.
Yeah, I think it's pretty much. I mean, Elder Paisios doesn't have an idealized self-image. He's free of that.
Mm-hmm. Seth's working on that. He tells me everything's wrong with me. He even makes stuff up.
Keep you off balance.
Yes, it does. So. I guess it may be harder to see that. You know, I mean, when he's talking about moving toward people or against people or away from people, he asks the question, is it possible that I do this?
Very gently.
Yeah, or I do this, and I can say, no, I don't do that. But then there's one, oh, I think I do that. Yeah. This one's a little harder. He didn't have the question yet.
So. I think he's satisfied if he can shake our confidence, in our unquestioning confidence in our self-image. You know, so that we begin to question it. Is this possible? The worst thing is to just absolutely affirm it, our self-image, as reality. We're not going to all of a sudden get rid of it, like he says. But if we at least can avoid, again and again, affirming it as the ultimate reality, instead of Christ, instead of God, instead of the reality of our actual, real situation, we have a terror of the freedom that we have in the world, because after all, death is in the world. We're going to want to find something to depend on. It's going to lead us to try to create some kind of false sense of security. Jimmy always laughs whenever I use that expression, the false sense of security. But it always is a false sense of security. It's always a false.
The sense of security is always false.
The sense of security that we had is always false. It's always a false sense of security. How could it be anything else?
That caused me to crash my car one time.
Oh, God. What's that? Having a false sense of security? Yes. I think I looked up
and saw that nobody else was on the road, and so I reached for my fork again.
You reached for your fork? Took your attention away from
my plate.
Not that much.
Over and over again. Because I, being the sane person that I was, kept putting it back on the plate, and it kept sliding off. I kept putting it back on.
I think a lot of people crash cars because of a sense of security.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We feel like we're in control.
Yeah. Or even think your car can stay on that road and it's got water all over it, and you're going 70 miles an hour. Try to change lanes, that doesn't work.
Probably a little too comfortable on that balcony out there, too.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm at least recognized.
Balcony? What balcony?
Network.
Building downtown.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's in the book of Acts, too, right?
What's that?
Some young man sitting in.
Well, he fell asleep.
He felt secure sitting in that window, so where there, and there was long ways down. And
yeah.
He felt secure there, and he fell
asleep up there.
Paul was talking Paul for brought a him long back time.
And Paul
put him right to sleep.
Yeah.
And the Apostle Paul, prayed for his healing, right? So he was healed. And
yeah, healed him. I think that was Mark.
They say
that's
Mark.
Oh, that Mark. Was Mark that fell? Huh.
I didn't know about that.
In the book of Acts, yeah.
Okay, we could do a little more. Or, you know, this next section is lengthy. I don't know. We could start it. We're not going to make it through it. Setting aside our real self. We could at least start to think about that. Let's just do that. Page 149. What's involved in setting aside our real self? Okay, are we serving an idol? Setting aside our real self and focusing on an idealized image. The idealized image, the idealized self-image, is our imaginary fictitious self, we've said. But at the same time, it also has real elements. One believes in God, the gospel, Christianity, the church. This faith is a real quest on the part of his soul. But since the soul doesn't move correctly, and this happens since conflicts are created within the soul because it doesn't take within it the correct position before God, that's the problem. Before God, before itself, and before others, we're not realistic. We don't know ourselves as we actually are. It seeks, but what it seeks and what it looks for isn't what it really should seek and look for, but something the soul fashions by itself. It's an idealized image. For example, while holiness is a real search, I'm jumping down to the next paragraph, and an inclination of the soul, when the person doesn't seek it correctly, then he fashions an idealized image. And of course, I mean, we follow the path of least resistance. We don't look for the most difficult way. That is, a fake, fictitious, imaginary image of holiness, of perfection. And he identifies it with himself. He identifies it with himself. Since all the inclinations and searchings of the soul are directed toward this idealized image, top of 150, the personality is set aside. Now, what he means by personality is the way we are as God has created us before our effort to create ourselves begins. The person that we are is set aside. Our self is set aside. Our real self is set aside. It goes off in a corner, and what remains is this fictitious thing, this imaginary thing. We think that we really are striving for holiness, perfection, and that which we should be seeking and striving for, and that it is this that we work for. However, we are serving and worshiping something imaginary, something that is an idol. 3 lines down. Perhaps these disturbances and conflicts have existed from childhood years, perhaps from teenage years, and since the soul can't bear to live with these conflicts, with this disorder that exists within it, but at the same time it can't provide a correct solution, it takes refuge in the idealized image. Why does the person bind himself so closely to the idealized image? The idealized image is actually good for us up to a certain point. It's a start, kind of like keeping busy at, you know, because there's real elements, remember. A great many good Christians attached to this idealized image manage to appear balanced, calm, superior, and in this way they have demands and claims on others in life. But as soon as something, an incident, some event, undermines this idealized image, since it's imaginary, fictitious, and not real, one is forced, one is compelled to see his real self, to see his shortcomings. 5 lines down. The conflicts and all the confusion that exists inside him. 3 lines down. It is something very important for the person to see after an event, after a shocking occurrence, that he isn't who he thought he was, and to see himself in such a way that he can no longer stand to live, to feel that he's crushed. It's a good thing for a person to find himself in such a situation. It's an opportunity for him to stop living with his imaginary, fictitious, made-up self, to make a decision to come down to earth and begin his life from the beginning, and from that point on to live with his real self, to see his real self, and to move with it toward God, to seek God, to seek holiness, perfection. But it's very difficult for this to happen. Very difficult. That's probably a good place to stop.